Today is Wednesday, May 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Donald Trump hints that a meeting with North Korea is not a sure thing. Congress will review highly classified information on the Trump-Russia investigation.
The president is going to fight to keep this truth from coming out, and we are in for a series of constitutional crises.
Stern warnings to Iran from the new Secretary of State. Also ahead, four courageous canines are given the highest military honor at a ceremony in Washington. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump says his planned summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un might not take place next month. Trump, speaking at the White House alongside South Korean President Moon Jae-in, said he believes Kim is serious about the planned talks, but that there are certain conditions that need to be met. And he didn't say what those are.
Well, we're moving along and we'll see what happens. There are certain conditions that we want, and I think we'll get those conditions. And if we don't, we don't have the meeting. And frankly, it has a chance to be a great, great meeting for North Korea and a great meeting for the world. If it doesn't happen, maybe it'll happen later. Maybe it'll happen at a different time. But we will see.
The summit planned for Singapore offers a historic chance for peace on the peninsula, but also the risk of an epic diplomatic failure that would allow the North to revive and advance its nuclear weapons program.
He will be extremely happy if something works out. And if it doesn't work out, honestly, he can't be happy. But he has a chance to do something that maybe has never been done before. And I think it would be, if you look 25 years into the future, 50 years into the future, he will be able to look back and be very proud of what he did for North Korea and actually for the world.
Still, Moon, speaking through an interpreter, credited Trump for bringing about the recent positive change of tone from North Korea.
Thanks to your vision of achieving peace through strength, as well as your strong leadership, we are looking forward to the first ever U.S.-North Korea summit, and we find ourselves standing one step closer to the dream of achieving complete denuclearization on the Korean Peninsula and world peace.
But skepticism about the North's intentions have mounted in recent weeks after Kim's government pulled out of planned peace talks with the South last week, objecting to long-scheduled joint military exercises between the U.S. and South Korean forces. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on Tuesday said the administration's moving forward in advance of any potential summit between Trump and Kim, with the goal still aimed at denuclearization.
We are continuing to prepare both our team and the White House so that in the event that the summit takes place on June 12th, we are fully prepared, with the mission statement having not changed at all.
The North also threatened to abandon the planned Trump-Kim meeting over U.S. insistence on rapidly denuclearizing the peninsula. And joining us now to talk more about it is Robert Deitz, a professor at the Schar School of Public Policy at George Mason University.
What's happening with respect to Kim Jong-un is not surprising to people who have watched North Korea. It is probably surprising to Mr. Trump. One of the frustrating things that people at state and the intelligence community have is that the knowledge, the expertise, the common wisdom that has developed in these organizations over decades tends to be ignored by Mr. Trump. And that's enormously frustrating, so that if you asked a person, a North Korea hand at state, he or she would say, yes, that's exactly what we said initially when this possibility first arose.
Which was what?
That not so fast. North Korea has a history of embracing some sort of arrangement and then backing out of it, usually with a blast at the U.S. And this happened with his father repeatedly, by the way, in different administrations, not just Republican. It happened with Mr. Obama. It happened with President George Bush the Elder. And so there is this history of sort of raise hopes, expectations. The U.S. does something in good faith, makes a gesture in good faith, for example, allowing imports of foodstuffs. And then North Korea says comes up with some sort of pretext why what we did wasn't good enough, and you know denounces the U.S. as international imperialists and so forth.
Well, there were also some big concerns about the North's motives and their long-term goals for their own country, with the disclosure of a Pentagon report to Congress saying that nuclear weapons were central or are central to North Korea's strategic goal of ensuring the perpetual rule of the Kim family dynasty. Apparently, this report was assessments from developments in 2017.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't take a Pentagon report to know that. I mean, there's no member of a dynasty who's willing to say, and by the way, for the good of the country, we're willing to step down and hold democratic elections. I mean, whatever else he is, Un is not a Jeffersonian Democrat. And so, of course, self-preservation is important. I think part of what put Un on edge is Mr. Bolton's comment that what he foresaw for Korea was a kind of Libya outcome. Well, of course, what he had in mind is Libya's giving up nuclear weapon aspirations. But, of course, what Un took from that is, wait a minute, what happened to Muammar Gaddafi? Well, as you know, he was ousted and eventually, well, not even eventually, he was killed. And so I think he's saying to himself, wait, you mean what the U.S. has in mind is I surrender my nuclear ambitions, then there's regime change, and then I'm killed.
In North Korea, beyond all of this talk of whether or not this summit will take place, foreign journalists were there to watch the dismantling of a nuclear test site that could potentially be a significant concession. Others are sort of speculating that the site was not really operating properly anyway, so it wasn't that big of a concession.
I tend toward the latter view, that it was not much of a concession. I believe this site is at what was called a sick mountain. A sick mountain is a mountain that's ready to collapse. And apparently during that really big test that was done, what was it, about a year ago, what was claimed to be a hydrogen bomb, the photos from outer space actually saw this mountain move. And the concern is what happens with a sick mountain is at some point the whole thing just collapses. And so what Mr. Un may have been giving is basically air, by which I mean that he's giving nothing away, that this site was not usable anymore.
Do you think it's even possible that he would consider actually completely giving up nukes?
No. You know, it's one thing for Iran to do it, because Iran is not a one-person dictatorship, and particularly a cult. North Korea is. You know, assume for a moment that Un says, okay, I'm going to give up all nuclear weapons, and this is all verified. What's there to stop regime change, either internally by disaffected North Koreans, I'm sure they're a fair number, or from South Korea, or for that matter, through some sort of guerrilla undertaking by the U.S. or other Western nations? Nothing. So no, very hard for me to see how that could happen.
All right, that's Robert Deitz, professor at the Schar School of Public Policy at George Mason University. President Donald Trump declined to say Tuesday whether he has confidence in Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, escalating the pressure on the Justice Department as his White House negotiated rare access to classified documents for his congressional allies. Asked if he has confidence in Rosenstein, who's overseeing the special counsel's Russia investigation, he told reporters to move on to another question. Comments came just before White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders announced that a meeting to allow House Republicans to review highly classified information on the Russia probe will happen on Thursday.
The president asked Chief of Staff Kelly to set up the meeting. It is scheduled to take place on Thursday of this week. The individuals that are expected to attend are Chairman Nunes, Chairman Gowdy, FBI Director Wray, DNI Director Coates, and DOJ official Ed O'Callaghan. No one from the White House staff will attend.
Nunes, an ardent Trump supporter, has been demanding information on a source in the Federal Bureau of Investigation in the Russia investigation. But the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Panel, California Representative Adam Schiff, said the briefing should have included Republican and Democratic leaders as well. Joining us now to understand more of this is Jeremy Mayer, associate professor at George Mason University. What do you make of what's happening here?
It's an act and a moment unprecedented in American presidential history, because the president of the United States is continuing to attack his own Department of Justice and the FBI. And this week, Trump took it to a whole new level by alleging that the FBI was spying on his campaign.
When you say it's unprecedented, is it because a president normally doesn't get involved with its Justice Department telling them what to investigate?
Yes, there's been a presumption that the Department of Justice should have a degree of autonomy from political control. That is, the president shouldn't go into the DOJ and say, investigate this guy, don't investigate this guy. There's been a potential problem that law school professors have always wondered about. What if the president himself is a target of a DOJ investigation? But Trump really is the first president to run into this problem square in the face. To a degree, Nixon did. To a degree, Clinton did. But nobody responded the way Trump has.
What do you make of the response from the Justice Department agreeing to investigate the president's concerns, even though many speculate that he's just trying to turn the attention to try to sort of, you know, dissuade from the accusations that could be coming toward him?
I think the Department of Justice is trying whatever it can to avoid a constitutional crisis. So if they can, by referring this to the Inspector General, keep it from becoming a situation where top leadership of the DOJ resign in the face of what they consider an unlawful presidential request, they're going to do that. And I think that's what you saw happening this week.
But if it's a potential violation of presidential protocol, could it also have an impact on federal law enforcement and its use of informants? We know that they've already pretty much outed someone that was an FBI informant that has been helping in this Russia investigation or has provided information.
This was a very strange event because when you were reading the press coverage last week, it sounded like this person was a deep cover operative, that the revelation of his identity would damage a number of ongoing investigations or expose people who cooperated with him. And it turns out, as far as we know, that the person who's been revealed was a well-known CIA source and affiliated scholar. So I'm a little confused. There may be another shoe yet to drop, because there's some discussion that they may not have been the only FBI informant. But the FBI is right in the sense that if it becomes doubtful that the FBI can keep people's identities secret, fewer and fewer people will want to cooperate with the FBI.
What about the fact that the president and his attorney are demanding intelligence officials turn over the evidence and information they may have that directly has to do with the probe into the Trump campaign potentially colluding or, you know, with Russia, that whole situation? I mean, what do you make of
that? So the president of the United States has been engaged in a month-long effort to delegitimize the investigations into him. And I think that's the context in which we want to see these latest revelations. The president is angry that people allegedly spied on his campaign. But there's another way to look at that, and that is that the FBI is the counterintelligence agency in the United States government, not the CIA, not DHS, but the FBI is tasked with preventing Russian, Chinese, and other foreign intelligence services from infiltrating their way into American institutions. And a presidential campaign has never, as far as we know, been a target before. But we have very good reason to think that Russia was targeting the Trump campaign, and so the FBI maybe wasn't infiltrating, but actually trying to protect the Trump campaign from being infiltrated.
Where does this all go? What do you see happening here? How concerned are you?
I think it is perhaps the greatest threat to American democracy since the founding, because if it is true, and we don't know that it's true, but if it is true that Russia was colluding with the Trump campaign to win an election, and the president is going to fight to keep this truth from coming out, then we are in for a series of constitutional crises.
All right, that's Jeremy Mayer, associate professor at the Schar School of Public Policy and Government at George Mason University. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Uganda seeks safer motorcycle taxis. 16-year-olds in Washington, D.C. fight for the right to vote. Iraq's election creates new U.S. uncertainties. And new eruptions in Hawaii send lava closer to a major power plant. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo Monday unveiled a far-reaching list of demands for any new nuclear deal with Iran and threatened economy-crushing sanctions if Tehran doesn't change its behavior. The new warning came in a speech laying out the Trump administration's strategy following the U.S. decision to pull out of the Iran nuclear agreement. VOA's Bill Gallo reports.
Lots of pressure, lots of demands. That was Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's message to Iran Monday.
These will indeed end up being the strongest sanctions in history when we are complete. After our sanctions come in force, it will be battling to keep its economy alive.
Pompeo's speech was an attempt to outline U.S. policy moving forward after President Donald Trump pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal earlier this month.
We're open to new steps with not only our allies and partners, but with Iran as well, but only if Iran is willing to make major changes.
Those changes include Iran agreeing to abandon its nuclear weapons indefinitely and allowing U.N. inspectors access to nuclear sites anywhere in the country. Pompeo also demanded a stop to Iran's ballistic missile tests and an end to its support for Middle East militant groups.
Secretary Pompeo was looking for something we call big for big, which is a resumption of diplomatic ties, removing basically the bulk of American sanctions architecture in exchange for dealing with every single aspect of the Iranian threat.
But it's not clear how much pressure the United States can apply without Europe, which is working with Iran to salvage the nuclear deal. Last week, the European Commission started a process that would protect European companies that still want to do business with Iran.
And we want to hear their concerns. But, you know, we will hold those doing prohibited business in Iran to account.
Despite the increased pressure, the National Iranian American Council says Iran is unlikely to accept U.S. demands.
This is not what a rational actor actually would respond to. And I think what we've learned, as much as we disagree with Iran, they do conduct things with a cost-benefit analysis of a rational actor. And Pompeo has not presented any sort of pathway that they could actually comply with.
Iran's president, Hassan Rouhani, dismissed Pompeo's speech, saying it's not up to the United States to decide what was best for the world or Iran. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Washington.
Well, preparations are underway for a mass Ebola vaccination campaign in the Democratic Republic of Congo as the Ministry of Health and international aid agencies hold a second day of inoculations in northwestern Equator province. The latest World Health Organization estimates report 51 cases of Ebola, including 27 deaths. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from World Health Organization headquarters in Geneva.
More than 7,500 doses of the Ebola vaccine have been shipped to the Democratic Republic of Congo. WHO spokesman Tarek Jazarevich tells VOA he expects the campaign to accelerate and ultimately reach thousands of people. Jazarevich says a lot of work has to be done before this complex operation can hit its stride. For example, he says transporting the vaccines and storing them in freezers in affected areas is a major challenge. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Well, preparations are, as we said, underway, and we'll keep you up to date on that story. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Coming up this Sunday, sounds of the xylophone. Whether you know it as the marimba or timbila, the balani or the gil, it rings out in many of its various tones and timbres in this episode to honor the recent passing of one of Ghana's master gil players, the late Bernard Woma. But I've also got other great tunes for you too. Current hits from Southern Africa, new releases by Ghana's Rocky Dawuni and Susu and Maher Sissoko.
Burn one, baby, burn.
Don't miss it. Join me. Music Time in Africa this Sunday and the following Saturday at 15 and 2000 UTC.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, we've often hear about top medals and other honors bestowed on American service members who've risked their lives to protect the country. But on Tuesday, a special group of unsung heroes was presented with the K-9 Medal of Courage. the nation's highest honor for military dogs. The organization American Humane honored Man's Best Friend at a special award ceremony on Capitol Hill, and their stories are quite remarkable. I did get a chance to go there and meet them at the event.
Today, we are pleased to honor four courageous military dogs, each of whom who have served their units, their handlers, and their country with distinction.
Dr. Amy Bucullah is National Director for Military Affairs for American Humane. What's this event all about?
This is American Humane's third annual event to honor military working dogs who have served to keep our troops safe overseas, and now they are retired, enjoying life with some of their handlers and newly adopted families. In fact, today there are about 1,600 military working dogs, and these dogs are absolutely amazing what they can do, especially with their detection skills. Dogs' sense of smell is tens of thousands stronger than humans. And so no matter how much technology we've developed, nothing can beat these dogs' noses in helping detect weapons caches, IEDs, other threats to our troops. All four dogs are being honored for their overall bravery and years of service. They're all trained in detection work. Some of them also are duly trained for patrol work. But all of these dogs have worked very hard to keep our troops safe.
Heather Leader adopted 9-year-old Dutch German Shepherd, Taba.
We've had her since 2012. And before that, she was with the U.S. Armed Forces 10th Airborne Group with the Special Forces. She was deployed over in Afghanistan with the Special Forces Group from Fort Carson. And she was in countless raids out there, and she's also was very good, they said, at finding improvised explosive devices. When she returned home, there were some concerns with her engagement with the bite work and such, because she's a dual-purpose dog. Mm-hmm. So the decision was to go ahead and adopt her out, which we were able to pick her up because my husband's he was a canine handler at the time and now is a canine trainer.
And I see she may have some injuries from her deployment.
She had a right pain in her back leg, her right leg, and it's never really been able to be identified. And then it kind of comes and goes. And the last 2 months, it really got extreme. And we went and did x-rays, and it turned out she has osteosarcoma cancer. So they did an amputation to kind of alleviate that pain for her.
And how's she doing now?
Much better. We call her our little tripaw. I saw that name on the internet and thought it was great. She's very fast on it. She's rather entertaining because she still chases squirrels in the backyard and, quite frankly, does little pogo sticking on the back leg to try to get the ones in the tree. But it's been such an honor to be able to do this for her and to be able to celebrate her life and what she's done.
Micah Jones is canine sergeant for the Amtrak Police Department. His partner, Summer, is a 7-year-old Labrador Retriever and also one of the honorees.
We've been a team for going on 4 years now. First introduced to Summer, it was January 2014. My previous canine, Blecky, was retired, and I was due for a new canine through Homeland Security. So TSA sent this dog up from Lackland, and ever since then, we've been hit the ground running. When I first received her, like any handler, you're going to read about the medical conditions of the dog. And so at that time, I learned that she was in Kandahar 2012 with the 1st Battalion, 7th Marines. And ever since then, I made contact with the previous handler, learned a little bit more what she did over there, saving lives, finding IEDs, V-beds, been in firefights, been on routine patrols, finding weapons caches. And it's just an honor to work her, being considered a war dog. And myself being a war veteran from being 21 years in the military, Air Force, retired, I'm just an honor to work a war dog walking beside me every day.
And is this a dog that will stay with you?
Yes, ma'am. So I've had her for 4 years. She'll be 8 next month. She still probably has a good couple of years to retire. So when she retires, she'll be my pet and not my working dog. But she'll forever be my hero.
In recognition of your courage, life-saving work, and extraordinary accomplishments in serving the armed forces and our nation, we hereby award you with the American Humane Lois Pope Life Canine Medal of Courage.
And the American Humane Canine Medal of Courage Award Ceremony honoring man's best friend. Former President Barack Obama and wife Michelle Obama have entered into a multi-year agreement to produce films and series with Netflix. That's the American-based internet entertainment service that streams movies, shows, and original programming across the world. The Obamas will produce a diverse mix of content, including the potential for scripted series, unscripted series, docuseries, documentaries, and features. And ultimately, the projects will be available to the 125 million member Netflix households in 190 countries. The AP's Jackie Quinn has more.
The former president and first lady will produce a diverse mix of content, some scripted, some not, and documentaries and features. An insider says they'll participate in some of the programming, but not all, and the aim is to keep it nonpartisan. Former President Obama says they hope to cultivate and curate the talented, inspiring voices that can promote great empathy and understanding. No material is expected until at least 2019 from the new Obama production company, Higher Ground. I'm Jackie Quinn.
I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, managing editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This month marks the celebration of Cuban independence, won by patriots who wished for individual freedom and the right of self-determination. Sadly, both have been tragically snuffed out by a tired communist regime, said President Donald Trump. Cuba remains under the repressive thumb of the Communist Party, even as a new president was recently instated, Miguel Díaz-Canel. According to the latest State Department human rights report, Cuban government officials, at the direction of their superiors, commit most of the human rights abuses, and impunity for the perpetrators remains widespread. Regardless, said President Trump, the brave people of Cuba continue to work under continued oppression and extraordinarily difficult circumstances to provide for their families and to restore human and civil rights. The names of great Cuban leaders who fought for independence, such as José Martí and Antonio Maceo, echo through history alongside names like Washington and Jefferson, said President Trump. The legacy of these leaders continues to inspire and encourage all peoples to remain committed to fight for democracy and the restoration of political, economic, and religious freedoms. The resilience of the Cuban people and the contributions of the Cuban-American community demand our respect, the president noted. The United States recognizes the many contributions of literature, the arts, music, cuisine, and entrepreneurship that these communities have given to the world. President Trump extended his warmest wishes to the people of Cuba who yearn for true freedom and to the Cuban-Americans who reside in the United States. He said, "We remember the Cuban patriots who lit a flame of freedom that will never be fully extinguished as long as men and women can dream of a better tomorrow. Let us recommit ourselves to a better, freer future for the Cuban people."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.